lady from Israel who hated cockroaches really bad. And there was a big cockroach in her apartment one day when she went in there and she looked at that and she thought, oh my goodness, I need to kill this cockroach. So she jumped up and down on top of it. And when she got done, she looked at it, it was just huge, and it kept moving. And she thought, I just cannot stay in the same apartment with this huge cockroach that won't die. So she got a paper towel and she picked it up and she took it to the bathroom and she put it in the toilet. And she looked at it in the toilet and it was still moving around. And she thought, I'll just flush it down the toilet. And then she thought, no, if I flush it down the toilet without knowing it's dead, it might come back. And so she went and got a can of insecticide. And she came back and she sprayed the insecticide on the cockroach. And it just kept moving and moving and moving. And so she emptied the entire can of insecticide on the cockroach until it was completely gone. And finally the thing stopped moving. And she was just like, it was just an ordeal for her. And she just closed the bathroom door and left. And she went and she sat in the living room. And after a while, her husband came home. And he went in the, he went in the bathroom and it's his custom to smoke a cigarette, I guess. And he threw the butt in the toilet, and in the toilet exploded and burned him on some very sensitive places. And she called the paramedics, and he was unable to really describe what had happened to him. And so the paramedics came and they got him on. They took one look at him and said, "You are in desperate need of medical attention." And they started to put him on the gurney, and then they said, they made a mistake, and they were near the steps, and they made a mistake of saying to the wife, "So what happened here?" And then she described it to them, and they got to laughing so hard that they dropped him off the gurney, and he broke his pelvis and fractured two ribs. And that's probably an urban legend. Wouldn't you say? It could not have happened. But I will guarantee you this, you will never get through marriage without unmentionable hurts. You will never get through marriage without getting hurt. Nobody gets through any human relationship, especially one that's loaded with such powerful expectations as marriage, without having some really hurts that require some serious treatment. Guarantee it. It's true. Let me review before we tell you what the last log is to put on the fire, the last one I'm talking about since I had four times to talk, that we can put on the fire of married love to fuel married love and to warm your heart in that. I'm going to kind of give you a little review. In our first session, we were talking about Ecclesiastes, and we did a little study there, and the purpose of that was really just to show that this relationship, this companionship of marriage is really worth working on, not just this weekend, but just continually. It doesn't just happen. But it's something that, you know, because it tends to run down because of sin, you got to work on it. That's kind of what we said. And then we talk about these three different things that fuel married love. The first of which was, that was this afternoon. See, you got to go back to the whole thing. Yeah, the whole thing. These logs, the first one we talked about last night. And we were talking about the cross and use of sacrifice. That's right. Sacrifice. And it's laying down your life. Another way of saying that would be, number one, work on your marriage. Number two, make daily sacrifices. Daily sacrifices. It's real important that you realize that sacrifices may be huge, momentous. I'm going to lay down my life for you, but usually not. Usually it's just those daily, run-of-the-mill, okay, honey, I'll go back in and get more ice in your Coke kinds of things, you know? And then, that's the second thing, make daily sacrifices. And the third thing was, this morning, practice continual confession. Or another way of saying it, what's the Bible way of saying that? Walk in the light is what I was looking for. Yeah, you confess sins daily, but to walking in the light. Yeah, walking in the light is making continual confession. Welcome back, Bill. Good to have you back. I thought for a while that Bill just said enough, and he just left, and his wife was back there alone today, and I was thinking, well, what happened? Was it something I said? And then I investigated, and he has a legitimate excuse. You can ask him about that later on, but he's back now, so we can get back at it here. So that's why I'm reviewing, one of the reasons why I'm reviewing here. And that is, your marriage is worth working on. And I'll just say this real quick to kind of go back and talk about my kind of first point, just a little bit real quick. And that is that there's probably nothing else that you can do, you know, as a married person that has such potential of displaying the glory of God and displaying the Christian life and the ethic that is within Christianity than marriage. It really is. It's a great avenue for that. The book I referred to earlier by Gary Thomas, how many of you have read that book, Sacred Marriage? The idea behind the book is simply that your primary reason for being married is not to seek your own happiness, but to seek your own happiness is secondary to holiness. And I was like, it's almost like, oh yeah, well that makes a lot of sense now. Because what the idea there in his book, and I'm probably really cheapening the thesis of his book a little bit by trying to say it this way, but the idea in the book is that God gave you the person that you're with, and that person is going to be like sandpaper in your life, making something beautiful of you. If you yield to the Lord, that person is going to work on you. Yeah, I understand why you're not nodding. You're just like looking frightened, you know. Sandpaper, yes. Well, I'm sorry. I mean, I'm working this, okay? Help, you know, if you have a better way of saying it, you speak next year. I'm working as hard as I can here. It's like, God is perfecting holiness in you, and he uses a number of different tools, irritants, procedures, and your wife may be abrasive. Yes, I'm sure yours isn't, you know, or mine, but there are women like that, and that abrasive, and so you can say, when your wife is abrasive or your husband's a jerk, you can say, Lord, what on earth? You know, I was out of God's will when I married this guy. And the Lord probably says, that's right, you were. But guess what? My providence, my sovereignty overrides your dumb mistakes. I was still in that. That's true. And so he's doing a beautiful thing in you, and he's using just the right person for you. I can tell you interesting stories about that, but I don't want to get myself in trouble at a couple's retreat, so I won't. So work on your marriage, because it's an opportunity to grow in the Lord and to display graces and so forth. Second, make daily sacrifices. That's the first log in the fire. Make daily sacrifices, continual sacrifices. Third, practice continual confession. Walk in the light. Now, what happens then is you're going to find that, you know, if you confess something, you're going to kind of want a little reciprocal behavior there, right? You're going to say, hey, I'm sorry about being a jerk, and you are... Yeah, you know, you're kind of like, that's just kind of natural. It's almost like a lot of times, you know, when you go and you ask forgiveness, it's not really asking forgiveness. It's like going and saying, why don't you apologize for being, a jerk? And, you know, if I was, you know, I was probably wrong, but you were really wrong, you know, and we do that, right? That's just very common. Practice continual confession. What's the other one? Well, I believe it's this. It's forgiving. So in simplest terms, these three logs, if you will, that fuel the fire of love. Our daily sacrifice is one. Daily sacrifice. And the second one, daily sacrifice. And daily confession, regular confession. And a third one is daily forgiveness. Daily forgiveness. A lot easier said than done. I want to talk about that just a little bit. I heard about a fellow who did a retreat once at a Catholic monastery. And he was kind of like, wasn't familiar with Roman Catholic stuff, so he's looking around a little bit, you know. And he went back, and there was a confessional. And he thought, well, that'll be interesting. You know, we don't confess anything in that Baptist church, right? And so, that was a joke. We don't have confessionals. And he looked in there, and in the confessional, instead of it being like a regular confessional, they had stored a big file cabinet in there. And he closed the door, and he thought, how ironic, you know, a file cabinet in a confessional, you know. Now, this is not what you want to do in marriage. You know, this is when we get a confession from somebody, when we elicit, you know, a confession from somebody, we tend to go, thank you very much, I'll put that in your little permanent record. Because I may need that later. Maybe like next year I get to choose where we go on vacation based on your little indiscretion right there that I have a good record of. And I have a duplicate in a safe deposit box. In case I want to bring it back and use it on you. I know none of you would ever do something like that. That is right. We have text messages. We have an electronic trail. We're following you. Don't bring up stuff like that. Okay, come on, guys. Please. I'm supposed to stop at 3 o'clock here. It is 3, right? 3 o'clock, that's cool. So you don't want to file these away, but you want to learn to forgive. Again, easier said than done. I love what Ruth Graham said. I've said it before. You'll hear me say it again. She said a good marriage is a union of two good forgivers. A good marriage is a union of two good forgivers. Unless, of course, you plan on living a sinlessly perfect life, you need to learn to ask forgiveness, and you'll need to learn to forgive. I know if you're looking for something profound from me, you weren't going to get it this weekend in one sense, but this is really true. It's really very, very powerful. Now, how do you do that, though? How do you forgive when you're looking to a person to really love you special to really, that's the person that's going to meet those needs that for all your life you've longed to have those needs met. And they let you down. Matter of fact, I will even go as far as to say sometimes by a clear act of divine providence, he wants them almost to let you down on that. It's not quite exactly true, but it's a little shaky theology there. But God allows them to let you down. It's like, it's a part of the plan. So what do you do? How do you forgive somebody? In some cases here, you know, we may be talking about a number of things that have been repeated. In some cases, we might be talking about things that are extremely difficult, extremely painful, and very difficult to forgive, and very difficult to forget. How then do you do that? It takes a miracle to really forgive somebody. And we go to the same place. We go to the cross. Take a look in Ephesians, in your Bible, in Ephesians, in probably the verse my mother quoted to me more than any other verse, besides maybe "Ask for me, my house will serve the Lord." This might be the first or second verse, was Ephesians 4:32. And to get the context and go, let's read from verse 29. "Let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice, and be kind to one another, tenderhearted, and forgiving one another." You know this, right? "Even as God, for Christ's sake, hath forgiven you." The appeal there was to the cross. The appeal, be kind and tenderhearted and forgive one another. That, remember, you're a Christian, right? And you're the one that went to the cross and he forgave you for all that you've done. How can you not forgive somebody else for what they've done? Where do I find what I need to forgive the people that I depended on so much to do nice things for me and they didn't? It's at Calvary where I find that. Amy Carmichael, somebody said, "I can't forget." People that say, I forgive, but I'm not going to forget, have really probably not forgiven. You know? People that say, I forgive, but I can't forget. I understand that. I love this little book by Amy Carmichael, Missionary to India. How many of you have seen the little book, If? It's an amazing book. If you like books that are easy to read and fast and incredibly powerful, her book, If, is like that. I remember when I was reading that book years ago, and I came across this little quote. "If I say, I forgive, but I cannot forget, as though the God who washes all the sands on all the shores of all the world twice a day cannot wash these memories from my mind, then I know nothing of Calvary love." We say, you can't forgive if it's just a human transaction. But when you put the cross in the backdrop, and you see the Lord Jesus there, perfect, sweet, precious, sinless God on the cross, dying, and we say, no, he forgives, but I'm not going to forgive. He was perfect. And you and I are not. You go to the cross. Someone said this, and I think it's a very powerful thing, and I want to put it into play with married couples this weekend. Possessing the knowledge of someone's sin is a powerful and a dangerous thing. And you know, as married couples, you know stuff about that other person that maybe nobody else knows. Isn't it interesting? You got to love that person more than anybody else loves them, but you know them maybe better than anybody else knows them. You know the good, the bad, and the ugly. You know the dirt on that person. You know their selfishness. You know the funny, weird things they do. Do you want me to go into detail on this? You know a lot about that person. I'm humbled by that. I could tell you things that would get me in trouble again there too, but I won't. But I think this is a really powerful thought. When possessing the knowledge of somebody else's sin is a powerful, dangerous thing. What do you do with the knowledge of that other person's sin? What do you do with that? Do you file it away? I know you're not supposed to, but I wonder if you do. Do you say, well, I'm going to forget, but if I need it, I can go get it? Yeah. Or do you just release that and go to the cross and forgive that? How do I keep from becoming overwhelmed with discouragement when I hurt because I've been hurt. I like what it says in Hebrews 12. Why don't you open your Bible to Hebrews 12? This is really, we'll probably only refer to three passages, but this is one. Hebrews 12 is a wonderful passage about how God works in our lives. And again, this passage, it talks about holiness, how we become holy, and how he develops holiness in us, and how we can persevere when we're discouraged. But it also takes us to the cross. Hebrews 12, in verse 2, says, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and was set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself. Such hostility from sinners against himself. Jesus bore the hostility of sinful people upon himself. Torture, mocking, blasphemy. He didn't deserve any of that. Now, how do we persevere? It says, you persevere by looking unto Jesus, who endured the hostilities against him. How do you forgive? Not by fixating, on the thing that was done to you, but by seeing it with the cross in the background, by going to the cross. And what does it mean to forgive? I think a couple of things from my own experience that I think are helpful. To forgive means, when I say I forgive you, I'm saying I will not bring up your sin again. To God, to you, or to anybody else. Otherwise, is it forgiven? When I say, okay, my wife or someone of you are, and they say, will you forgive me? And I say, I forgive you. Then I'm kind of entering into a promise, into a covenant, saying, this is now released and I will not bring it up again. To you, to God, or to anybody else. Now I know what you're thinking. So you're thinking, wait a minute. If I let that guy off that easy, and I forgive him, and I say I'll never bring it up again, how are we going to keep him in line? How are we going to keep him from doing that stuff again? Wouldn't it be helpful? Well, I think sin needs to come back up again, but he needs to bring it up again. You need to bring your sin up, but he needs to bring up his sin again. And in other words, it's legitimate for us to go back and visit our past sin when it's like that sanctified hall of shame, and we're humbling ourselves, recognizing it's under the blood, it is forgiven, but it's kind of who we are, and then that magnifies the grace of God. But in the relationship, if I'm bringing up past offenses or past sins, they haven't been forgiven. They're weeds in the garden of my marriage. It means something else too, I think. I think it means I will not bring up your sin again. I forgive you means I will not bring up your sin again to God, to you, to others. I think it also means I agree to bear the pain and pay the price that your sin cost. I agree to bear the pain and pay the price that your sin cost me. So when you say to your husband, I forgive you, if you think about it, it doesn't just mean I'll give you a temporary emotional kind of release. It means I'm going to go fix supper tonight, at least one supper, and then we'll see from there. I forgive you. That's not what real forgiveness is. A very serious matter that requires the help of God, that is a very staggering thing that you cannot withhold and really call yourself Christian. Because that's what Jesus did. Jesus Christ took my sin and promised not to bring it up against me. He took my sin and promised not to tell other people. He took my sin and promised never to make, he took it away and promised never to bring it up against me again. And he suffered for my sin. He bore the pain of my sin. When I was preparing this, my dad came to my mind. If there's any good stuff in my parenting, I think a lot of it probably goes back to the way my dad would handle things. I can remember that. And my dad was hard on me when it came to acknowledging that I did something wrong. But then when he got you to the place where you really acknowledged that you did something wrong, I had this feeling from my dad. It was like, okay, Kenny, let's go clean up this mess now. And he didn't bring it up again, but it's like we're just like shoulder to shoulder cleaning up the mess of my sin. He's helping bear the pain. Here's what I'm trying to tell you. I honestly think it will help your marriage a ton If you take those hurts, whether they ask forgiveness or whether they don't ask forgiveness, and you take them to the cross and you say, I'm going to take this sin and I'm not going to bring it up to God. I'm not going to bring it up to others. I'm not going to throw it up to them. I'm going to absorb this and it's going to hurt and I'm going to bear the pain of this. And I'm going to help pay what this sin caused because I have forgiven my wife. And you may see this summer. She has a green thumb. She can grow flowers so beautiful. She's made our yard so beautiful in the past. Just banks of flowers. I love it. I also love to play football in the front yard. So it's kind of like can create tensions, you know, when you're out there with a bunch of kids in a small front yard playing football and she has these flowers. She does things like sets booby traps in the flowers, or she goes out there and she stands with the hose and she glowers at you like Hulk Hogan. Like, I dare you to come over here anywhere near my flowers. You know, I will hurt you so bad you will never forget this. Please don't get in my flowers. And Danny's getting really, really good. He's getting really, really athletic. And I was having trouble beating him on a pass pattern because I'm old, slow, fat, you know. And so I remember one day trying to beat him on a pass pattern. I just couldn't get behind him, you know. And so finally I thought, I know what I'll do. I'm going to go like over the flower bed and they'll hit me over there. He'll never expect that. So I ended up going like right through the flower bed very carefully so that I wouldn't hurt anything, just right through the flower bed, thinking I was going to lose him that way. I lost him. I was just like flat out running as fast as I could through the flower bed, and I forgot that my wife had put a wooden wagon in the middle of the flower bed and had flowers growing. It was just all covered up, and my shin hit that wagon, and I went down and just hit the ground so hard that it registered, you know, on machinery. It was like shock waves went over three or four counties, I think, and the kids came running up, and they looked at me like none of them talked. You know, they just went. And then I kind of rolled over and groaned a little bit. When I did that, they thought, okay, it's okay to laugh now. And then they just laughed and laughed and laughed. And Lois, I noticed, was not laughing because she knows if you're going to have flowers, you're going to have to stand guard on those. And you and I want marriages that are happy and beautiful. We want to have wonderful sexual experiences in our marriage. We want to have hand-in-hand times and fireside times. We want to have that happy sense of security that you can only have with another person that you're rightly connected with in the sight of God. But it cannot happen unless we do the things necessary to guard that. If we don't weed the garden or, you know, keep the thugs out of the garden, it isn't going to happen. And this cannot happen without forgiveness. It can't. You say, well, I want to have a good marriage, but I just don't want to forgive that louse. It's not going to happen. It cannot happen. And the person that gets hurt the most is the person who cannot or who will not forgive. This is a pleasure in not forgiving. You ever notice it? There's a kind of a perverse pleasure in saying, I know you haven't thought this, but I've got something on her now. And this is kind of delightful, you know? It's like, well, you're not perfect, are you? You know what I'm saying? And you got that little thing there, and you're thinking, you know, I'll forgive you. Next time life action comes, 3 or 4 years from now, you know, I'll forgive you. Until then, I'm just going to enjoy this little advantage that I have, you know? And you have that, and he knows it. She knows it. She knows that it isn't over. It's like, you know, you can just kind of look at him and go, you know. You don't have to say it. And the other person just hangs their head and they're like, yeah, I know. That's not Christian. But it's fun. It's a pleasure. It is. There's a little delight. There's a little perverse, sick kind of delight in that. There is. That's the way sin is. Sin always has little delights. It's like, it's fun. I'm going to nurse that. Hey, she hurt me. I'm not going to forgive her. That's what I'll do. And there's a little subtle things, a little passive resistance things, little subtle things that we do. And, you know, and they're very forgettable. They're very explainable. Like, why did you do that? You know, but we have conflicts in our marriage, little conflicts that if you actually describe what they were, you think, well, that's dumb. Why would you argue over where you're going to go to eat at a restaurant? But what it really is it's against the backdrop of all that junk, that unforgiven sin and that past stuff that hasn't been to the cross. And so there are things that you've done you haven't asked forgiveness for, or things that you haven't been willing to forgive, and you've been living selfishly, and so what you have is a pagan marriage that calls itself Christian. You really don't have a Christian marriage. Can't be a Christian marriage unless everybody stays broken at the foot of the cross. It can't be. It's not Christian. If the main thing that Jesus did was lay his life down on Calvary, a sinlessly perfect God and man laid his life down on Calvary for us, and we say we're going to withhold forgiveness from other people, I was in Jackson, a youth pastor years ago, and they called me in the middle of the night. They said there's a lady in the hospital, and she doesn't have a pastor, she doesn't have a church, and it's likely she's going to die, and she's asking for a pastor or a chaplain. And so I got in my car, drove across town that night, late at night, on a winter night, went in this room where this lady was laying there, very old, and I started to talk to her about the gospel. And she was kind of open. You could tell she was listening, and I was giving her the gospel. And as I gave her the gospel, and you could just tell that she was absorbing that, about three-quarters of the way into my explaining the gospel, I said something about, you know, sin and forgiveness, and she just launched into this diatribe of bitterness against her husband and what he had done to her and how he left her and how he hurt her. And she is almost like morphed into a hard, angry, callous, bitter person. She could not hear the gospel. You could feel it in the room. She could not hear the gospel. All she could do was just, her dying experience was one last grasp of the pleasure of hating that guy for what he did. There is a little perverse pleasure in withholding forgiveness, or a little sick advantage that you have emotionally over somebody else. But God offers you something so much more wonderful. He offers to let you do what he did and forgive the person, even though they don't deserve it. And there's a greater pleasure in that. That's what we need to see. We need to see that the great pleasure, the marriage that God intended for us, is only possible if we do the Christian things that are the components of Christian marriage. We went to Monterrey, Mexico, and we went on a bus with a whole bunch of young people. It was quite an experience. Got in this bus, left from Texas, drove all night long to Monterrey. It was horrific. It was hot. It was tired. We had to wear suits and ties. This was evil. And so here we are, suits and ties, crammed in the bus. Lois didn't want to sit with me. She wanted to sit with somebody smaller than me. It's mean, isn't it? Go ahead. Go ahead. Come on. Give it up. That's mean. Lois says, they don't know what to do, Lois. She says, I love you, honey, but can I sit with Wesley? Because he's small. So I went and sat with Anthony Burris, who's a huge guy. Anyway, so we're sitting there on the bus. I made that really sound bad, didn't I? I embellished that slightly. But anyway, so we're going on this bus all night long. It's hot. We're tired. And we're like, got to get to this certain orphanage to do this ministry at this particular orphanage at a particular time. And the kids are, you know, really tired and they're stretched to the limit. And we don't get anything really to eat at all. We don't stop to eat. We're just going. The bus driver was a real interesting guy. That was a character. I will not tell you about that. But anyway, it was something. By the time we got all the way to Monterey, it was like well into the next day, maybe 2 or 3 o'clock the next day. We haven't slept. We haven't eaten. We're hot. And we're supposed to jump off the bus and, you know, be real happy and minister to these kids in this orphanage. And we did. We got off the bus, and it was really a sweet thing to visit those kids in an orphanage and do a little ministry there and do some juggling and preach the gospel and tell some stories and visit with kids and all of that. And then we were supposed to go up to this hotel finally. Now, this is understanding we're going on the second day without any sleep, so we're really looking forward to getting in a hotel. And I'm looking forward to getting my family. This is what we say. You know, my family's tired. They need to sleep. You know, Ken wouldn't have minded a little sleep at that point, too. So, you know, we were going to go up there. And my boss says, we need to meet a businessman. And the bus is going to have to go on, and you and I are going to go up to meet this businessman in this really, really, really fancy restaurant way up in the top of this big tower in Monterey overlooking the city. And this guy is kind of like, does a sort of a Latin American welcome, you know, and I'm so glad you're here. We're going to be here for a long time. We're going to have many courses. I'm just delighted to be with you. And I was thinking, and so was my boss, we're thinking, these kids are sitting on the bus. They haven't eaten. They haven't slept. And here we are, and they're starting to bring this stuff out. I was like, oh. My boss says to me, get a hold of somebody and find out what's going on with them. My phone isn't working in Mexico. I can't do anything. And so he regularly kind of interrupts and says, try to get something. And I'm supposed to be his assistant making it happen, and I'm making nothing happen, you know. Ordering food was about all I was doing. And so finally they got that thing wrapped up. And he kind of cut it short, and he brought this businessman out to the bus to meet these kids. And they sang for him. And we drove up to the bus, and these kids have been up for a long time. They're very, very hot. They're very, very tired. And so my boss gets on the bus. He goes, "Hey, we have a man here we want you to meet. We want you to sing for him." And so the kids are out there. I just felt so bad for them. They're singing this song, this silly song they learned, you know. They're singing it. You can tell they're just tired. Finally, the guy leaves, and the bus starts up the mountain to go to this hotel. And on the way up the mountain, three-quarters of the way up the mountain, this knuckleheaded bus driver runs into a tree. Because he's being stubborn and selfish and mean, it was a spiritual matter, thank you very much, runs into a tree. I'm like, oh, you know, this is just awful. So it's a big fiasco. Finally, we get up there, and I'm just like, give me, you know, a key to a room so that I can get in a private place so I can stop acting like a Christian leader is supposed to act. Because I'm tired, and I'm hungry, and I'm irritated, and I've been, you know, I get this smile pasted on my face all day long because I'm a leader after all, you know. And I'm like, ugh. I said, I heard this free story. So we give the keys out to the girls. That's the girls' room, this is the boys' room, and this is me and Lois's room. And we start to go to the rooms, and somebody says, Pastor Pierpont, wait a minute. We've had a little mix-up. I'm like, yeah, well, I'm shocked. What was it? You know, we had a little mix-up, and we need to put you in, like, if you don't mind, we just have, like, one room for your family, and we need those keys that we gave you for those three rooms. And the only thing that kept me looking Christian on the outside was protecting my reputation. So I just smiled and said, that's no problem. And I gave them the keys back, and they gave me the key, and inside I went, this is ridiculous. And my dad, I'll be honest, I was like, this is wrong. Take my keys back. My family's tired. I'm dragging us across the country. You know, what on earth? This is ridiculous. I was just in my brain. I never said this, but it was like fireworks going up in my brain. And I'm like, I can't find this room. And so the guy, and I don't speak Spanish, you know, the guy's like, follow me. And so I start to follow this guy, and he's winding back behind something. And I'm thinking, where are they going to stick us? And we got to the very end of the hall, and this big, huge, thick wooden door opened up onto this palatial president's suite with three full bedrooms inside and hot tubs and a veranda that opened out overlooking this huge valley over Monterey. It's the most luxurious place I have ever seen in my life. I went back and I checked. It rented for 12,000 pesos a night. And I'm not good on math, but that's kind of like similar to $1,200 a night. Now, I could have said, look, I have my rooms, and I'm not giving up my rooms, which is what I felt like saying. I felt like the NRA guy. Pry these out of my cold fingers. That's when you'll get them, you know. But instead, I kind of like gave them up. And you have a similar option. It's true. You have a similar option. You can say, I am going to cling to the privilege of not forgiving, or I'm going to trust God that what he has in mind really is even better than the little sick, perverse delight of withholding forgiveness from somebody else. It's interesting when you read this in Hebrews, considering him, verse 3, who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted the bloodshed striving against sin. And have you forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons? My son, don't despise the chastening of the Lord, or be discouraged when you're rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. And if you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you're without chastening, which all become partakers, then you're illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us. We paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers in his holiness. I'm letting your wife rough you up because I want you to be holy. That's what's going on here. I'm letting your husband be the imperfect guy that he is. Because didn't you ask me? Didn't